But Rhiannon's going to come and just lead us through some verses from that passage, or these passages. Thank you, Rhiannon.
Today's reading can be found on 707 and 708-9 of the Church Bibles. So we are going to firstly read from Isaiah 24, verses 1 to 6. Then I will turn the page and go to 18 to 23. And then on 709, we'll be in Isaiah 26, verses 1 to 9. So I'll start with Isaiah 24, verses 1 to 6. See, the Lord is going to lay waste the earth and devastate it. He will ruin its face and scatter its inhabitants. It will be the same for priest as for people, for master as for servant, for mistress as for maid, for seller as for buyer, for borrower as for lender, for debtor as for creditor. The earth will be completely laid waste and totally plundered. The Lord has spoken this word. The earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. The exalted of the earth languish. The earth is defiled by its people. They have disobeyed the laws. Who violated the statuses and broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse consumes the earth. Its people must bear their guilt. Therefore, earth's inhabitants are burned up and very few are left. We turn to 18 and the second half of that. The floodgates of heavens are opened. The foundations of the earth shake. The earth is broken up. The earth is split asunder. The earth is thoroughly shaken. The earth reels like a drunkard. It sways like a hut in the wind. So heavy upon it is the guilt of its rebellion that it falls, never to rise again. In that day, the Lord will punish the powers in the heavens above and the kings on the earth below. They will be herded together like prisoners bound in a dungeon. They will be shut up in prison and be punished after many days. The moon will be abashed, the sun ashamed. For the Lord Almighty will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before its elders gloriously. Isaiah 26, verses 1 to 9. In that day, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. God makes salvation its walls and ramparts. Open the gates that the righteous nation may enter, the nation that keeps faith. You will keep in perfect peace him whose mind is steadfast because he trusts in you. Trust in the Lord forever. For the Lord is the rock eternal. He humbles those who dwell on high. He lays the lofty city low. He levels it to the ground and casts it down to the dust. Feet trample it down, the feet of the oppressed, the footsteps of the poor. The path of the righteous is level. O upright one, you make the way of the righteous smooth. Yes, Lord, walking in the way of your laws, we wait for you. Your name and renown are the desire of our hearts. My soul yearns for you in the night. In the morning, my spirit longs for you. When your judgments come upon the earth, the people of the world learn righteousness. Amen.
Thank you, Rhiannon. It's a passage, therefore, of great contrasts. We'll explore that in a minute or two. But my first question is this: who can you put your trust in? Now, it's not a rhetorical question, this. You're going to have to do some work. Each year, one of the opinion poll companies runs this survey. They ask a random selection of the British population the kind of trades and professions that they consider trustworthy and those that they consider most trustworthy, and the professions or trades that they consider least trustworthy. So my question this morning is, who do you think is in one category and who do you think is in the other? So let's start with the least trusted professions. Who's got a suggestion for the least trusted professions? Alison. Sorry? Estate agents. Yes, it's on my list. They're the fourth least trusted profession. Well done. Anybody else? David? Not on my list, but obviously you might have had a bad experience. Certainly, yes, I can understand why you might say that. Pete? Merchant bankers. Well, it just says bankers here. Yes, they're on the list, definitely. Well done. Nina? Politicians. Congratulations. MPs, 19% of people think that they are trustworthy. 19%. That's the least trusted trade or profession in the country. Lawyers. Lawyers are not on the list. No, they're not on the list. That's not on the list either, Norman. trust you. since I can honestly say I have no experience one way or the other, I can't comment. Journalists, they're on the list, that's right. They're the third least trusted profession. It's quickly going down the list then in order of worstness, that's the word. MPs, government ministers, journalists, estate agents, business leaders, people like me, I suppose, bankers, local councillors, trade union officials, charity chief executives, interestingly, and economists. Okay, let's talk about the most trusted profession. What do you think the most trusted profession is? Doctors are the second most trusted profession. Who's a doctor here, by the way, or has been? Congratulations. Did I hear someone say teachers? They're the third most trusted profession. Hands up those of you who are or have been teachers. Well done. Excellent. Come on, who else is on the list, do you think? Vicars. Yes, now clergy are in the list, but they've slumped to 69%. Because they do this survey every year, and over the last few years it has been coming down. I think you might think that's something to do with, you know, all these scandals about child abuse in the church and so on. But they're still among there, up there among them. Yeah. Nurses, excellent. The most trusted profession. More trusted than doctors. Okay? All right? Okay. So let me. Anyone else want to sort of say anything? No. So in order then, most trusted nurses, 93%. Then doctors, teachers, judges, scientists, police, clergy, hairdressers, TV news readers, and then the man and woman in the street. I'm not sure that's a trade or a profession really, but there we go. So my question, I suppose, is why do you think some professions or trades are in the most trusted category and others are in the least trusted? What's the difference? Is there a difference between those two types of groups of people, do you think? Profit. Say a bit more.
Making money. Whose single objective is to make money?
In it for themselves or in it for the company they're working for, yes? Any? Yeah. I think that there was a difference, wasn't there, between the people who, people in trades and professions which are felt to be the caring professions, the people who look after you, people who've got no side to them, and then on the other hand, you've got politicians, you've got business leaders or whatever, a trades union, all those kind of people who, when they speak, you just think they're speaking on behalf of a cause, and there's a question of integrity, perhaps, or something like that. So. Interesting, really. Some people look after others, don't they? Others are seen to be looking after themselves. Yeah. Now, that's the fun bit. The question of who you can trust, who you can put your faith in, Well, it's as old as society itself, isn't it? As soon as people came together in community, they had to work out who was trustworthy and who wasn't. And this question of trust is one of the bedrocks of the prophecy of the whole of Isaiah. And the context is significant. Enemies were all around. Stronger regional powers were circling Judah, threatening both Jerusalem and the entire Jewish way of life. There were internal divisions, which meant it was difficult to know whether you could trust your neighbor. It was easy to forget what their ancestors had taught about obeying the law, about trusting people, about faith, because people were so busy getting on with life. Then, now, much the same really, isn't it? And today we're sampling just passages from those four chapters in the middle of the book of Isaiah, which are sometimes known as the little apocalypse. Not because it's little in the sense of the kind of words it's talking, the issues it's talking about, little in comparison with, say, the book of Revelation in terms of how short it is, but not because of the dramatic descriptions of what's, what Isaiah's writing about. And the message of the prophet, at its most basic, is very simple, really. Dreadful things will happen. It will appear as though everything you thought was permanent is actually like dust. So do not place your trust in such things. Place your trust in God. One of the words that Rhiannon read to us, trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord himself is eternal. And Isaiah goes on to say that trust in God and a sense of humility, of knowing your place, go hand in hand. Verse 5 of chapter 26, God humbles those in power and authority, those on the least trusted list, if you like, those who trample on the oppressed, those who build their wealth in ways that keep the poor in poverty. It's not a unique theme, of course. Isaiah is following a long tradition. The psalmist says, do not put your trust in princes, in human beings who cannot save. And Paul said something much the same in Colossians when he said, set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. But we do, don't we? Many of us pay money for goods online. We expect them to come. We expect them to be delivered. We get quite cross if they don't. We put our trust in politicians despite what we think about them because we go out to vote for them. Even though, as I say, we probably have quite low expectations about what they will do for us. When we go to a restaurant and order food, well, we expect it to not give us food poisoning and to taste nice. When we buy a house, we trust it won't fall down or come with a free gift of Japanese knotweed or something similar. When we buy a car, we trust it works and will keep us safe. We take sensible precautions most of the time. We get things checked out. We sometimes pay people, such as solicitors or advisors, to look after our interests. And in case something goes wrong, we often rely on insurance to cover our losses. In short, the way we, the Christian community, the way we live our lives as people of faith is in many respects fairly indistinguishable from the way everyone else does. It's part and parcel of living in community, relying on this series of checks and balances to hold society together. You can't live in society without joining in. There are a few Christians, such as the Amish, who try and keep themselves separate for just this reason. But they're very few and far between. Now, I don't think there's any evidence that Isaiah was saying that we need to give up on our daily round of interrelationships with other people, but he is clearly saying that we shouldn't develop an over-reliance on them to the exclusion of what's really important. Don't get so bound up with going about your everyday business that you forget what matters, is what he's saying. And Jesus said much the same thing, but in a slightly different way. Seek first the kingdom of God and its righteousness. And all these things, food, drink, clothes, and so on, will be added to you. In short, it is our attitude to the things that we call our own that matters. The way we live our life, that's what's important. And what it is about us that will ultimately be judged. For although it's not a popular thing to talk about, these words from the Bible this morning are about judgment. In the words of the theme song for today, which we'll sing after I finish speaking, O Lord, the clouds are gathering, the fire of judgment burns, how we have fallen. But I need to tell you, there's no real agreement amongst commentators on what exactly the judgment is that this part of the book of Isaiah refers to. Every one of them, and indeed all of us, looks on the passage, looks on any passage actually, through a lens that we've acquired through our own learning, our own study, our own experience. I don't think we should worry about that. It would be very surprising if we did always agree with each other. God speaks through the ages, both through the words of people living long ago who wrote the scriptures, and if we open ourselves to him, through our minds and hearts as well, as we seek to understand them and what they mean for us in our own age. And that's what we're trying to do this morning. So commentators say different things, but the first and most straightforward view of these chapters is really the one I've just outlined, a challenge to the kingdom of Judah, and by extension, every reader ever since, a challenge to reassess priorities, to answer this question of who and what we trust in life. Because the answer to that question really does define who we are. We are given this terrifying word picture of what happens when things go wrong. It's a call to repentance. It's a plea to the nation, a plea to you, a plea to me, to trust in the God who can be trusted, who provides all our needs, and not to be led astray. However tempting the ways of the world, however seductive and persuasive the marketing messages of those with vested interests, remember again why we trust some professions and not others, they ultimately lead to nowhere at best and ruin at worst. And what's more, this is a twofold message. It's a warning on the one hand and a message of comfort and of hope on the other. Now, this sounds very strange to us, the shock of the switching of scenes in the space of a verse from promising peace to foretelling suffering, from good news to bad news. How can we possibly welcome this bad news and indeed potentially look forward to it? It's the difference between a flowing melody and crashing chords of dissonance, between angry rap, if you like, and heavenly choir. I think we're all much more comfortable with the beautiful poetry of resting in God's peace and security than we are contemplating how awful things could be, how awful the devastation of all that we take for granted. But Isaiah insists that these two go together. They have to go together. We all know that evil appears to flourish in the world around us, but sometimes we try to hide from it, insulate ourselves from it, pretend it's not there, live our lives as though it wasn't going on around us. As I've said, Isaiah was talking and writing at a time when all around Israel, foreign powers were circling. The threats seemed to be coming from all directions. All the old certainties seemed to have broken down. And what's more, the enemies were within as well. As to earn a living, people crossed boundaries to trade, just as they do today. And as these first verses in Isaiah chapter 24 put it, the laying waste of the earth will affect everyone, priest and people, master or mistress and servant, seller and buyer, borrower and lender, debtor or creditor, everyone who joins in the daily round of business of everyday life. All people, all of us, in some way are compromised. We've all got our hands to a greater or lesser extent dirty in the grubby business of daily life. that inevitably drags us down. But we can, if we hear and sing the Lord's song, this is what Isaiah says, we can, if we hear and sing the Lord's song, rise above that. Chapter 26, verse 3, you, God, will keep in perfect peace those whose minds are steadfast because they trust in you. And so in this first interpretation, the emphasis is on the nation and the people within it. When we read in Isaiah chapter 24, verse 1, that the Lord is going to lay waste the earth, it doesn't necessarily mean the whole world. That would not have been a concept Isaiah's readers, or Isaiah as the writer, or his readers, would understand, because they had no concept of the world beyond their experience. We call the planet on which we live Earth, don't we? The Hebrew word for Earth can also be translated in other ways. It can be translated as ground, or land, or country. Just as if you think about it, the word Earth in English has more than one meaning. So this first interpretation of these chapters is essentially this. Things in the land of Judah were going to get bad, but God and his purposes will win through, and God will protect those who trust in him, from which we can derive our own personal message of hope in our lives, in our time. The second group of commentators see in these chapters a foretelling of something that is still, that was still to happen, still yet to happen, even in our day, and read it as a prophecy of the Christian apocalypse. In phase one of this story of the last times, which you can read about also in Revelation, mankind can anticipate the destruction of everything we know about. And then in phase two, once this badness has been purged, there will be the return of Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, who will come back to reign on Mount Zion in Jerusalem. Something still to look forward to, in other words. This follows one of the earliest strands of thinking in the church, which was to see in this book of Isaiah hundreds of passages which foretell Jesus' life and work. And what happens after his life had come to an earthly end. So much so, indeed, that again from early days, Isaiah has actually been called the fifth gospel. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Isaiah. So much of what we see is the story of Jesus as the coming of the Messiah is foretold in the book of Isaiah that it has been called the fifth gospel. Jesus stood out from all the teachers and prophets of his day, of which there were many, because he was the one that the writers of old had written about. And that was really a way in which the early Christians sought and saw a kind of legitimacy, a kind of reality of God speaking through the ages and his message being fulfilled in the life and teaching of Jesus. That's why the book of Isaiah is really so important to us as Christians. But it has to be said, I think, that some passages from Isaiah are far more easily read of prophecies about Jesus than others. We have in this last verse of chapter 24 these words, which follow all those words about the awesomeness and awfulness of the time of destruction. Isaiah goes on to say, then the Lord Almighty will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem with great glory. Now, I read this as straightforwardly talking about a promise that God himself will be restored to his rightful place in the most holy Jewish place. Jehovah, Yahweh, back ruling where he belongs in Jerusalem. But as I say, some see this as identical to the teaching in the New Testament about the return of Christ in glory at the end of time. Jerusalem is where Christ will appear when he returns. But whatever the real context of these words, the challenge is the same as what I call first interpretation. Be warned, God's purposes may be hidden, They may for a time appear to be frustrated, but ultimately they won't be hidden. They can't be frustrated. Ultimately, everyone will recognize God's power and authority over all. There's a third reading of these words which focuses on this same principle of a final reckoning, but without any specific teaching about Jesus coming again in Jerusalem. For that, the argument runs, we have to await the birth of Jesus and turn to the Gospels, to Paul, the other New Testament writers. And if we then want to, we can put those two stories together. Isaiah was talking about something else, but you can read in those words and you can read them in the context of the New Testament writers. But by itself, just talking about God's fulfillment at the end of time across the whole world is something that Jews and Christians can agree on. Because it says Isaiah here wasn't explicitly talking about a future man called Jesus. And looking backwards rather than forwards for a minute, it's interesting to see how Isaiah builds on words in earlier parts of the Bible. Isaiah is echoing the story of the great flood in Genesis. We didn't read this, it's in the middle of these four chapters. We did read this actually. The floodgates of the heavens are open, the foundations of the earth shake, the earth reels like a drunkard. So heavy is the guilt of its rebellion that it falls, never to rise again. That is strong stuff. God promised Noah that he would never again would destroy all life by the waters of a flood. He gave his rainbow as a sign of that covenant. But mankind came back and disobeyed that covenant, disobeyed holy laws. And when that happens, creation becomes dysfunctional. The covenant is then fractured. And mankind reaps the reward of that breaking of that covenant relationship. That's what this is about. And so if my first question this morning was, who do you put your trust in? The question here is, what on earth is the world coming to? Now, I could, but I'm not going to ask for your ideas on this one. But it is easy to think that the world is rushing headlong into destruction, isn't it? And to find parallels in these words of Isaiah that seem to fit and predict what we see happening around us. What is the world coming to? Now, you will call up in your own mind your own images here. Perhaps President Trump and Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un promising to rain fire and fury down on each other's nations like the world has never seen. These are words that our leaders are quoting to each other. We've floods, we've earthquakes, we've terror attacks, we've global warming. We have the threat that billions will die because antibiotics will become useless. I could go on. So much to fear, so much to be afraid of, so much evil, so much danger. I could go on, but it would spoil your lunch. So, my question, are we living in the end of time, or at the end of time as we know it? That's a big question, isn't it, for a Sunday morning? Well, we just don't know. And Jesus said he didn't know either, so well, that's good enough for me. People have predicted the end of the world or thought they were living in the last days before and have been very wrong. Imagine you were in the ruins of Hiroshima or Nagasaki, dying of radiation sickness, surrounded by this truly apocalyptic scene of destruction. It must have felt like the very end of the world. Just as it would have done if you were a Jew in the German death camps. But you can go further back, and as a historian, I like to go further back. Imagine you were a Christian in what is now Turkey, when the Islamic Ottoman Empire swept away over 1,000 years of Christian civilization in the 15th century. Or go back even further to the end of the Roman Empire in the 5th century, when the pagan hordes overwhelmed what seemed permanent, what seemed worth putting your trust in. Peace of the Roman Empire was something that people talked about because it seemed permanent, but it wasn't. Turned to dust like everything else. Or one more example, imagine you lived in one of those forgotten villages that dot our landscape, which were depopulated in the Black Death in the 14th century, when everyone around you seemed to be dying of this mystery illness. It's estimated that across Europe at the time, over 60% of the population died of the Black Death. Imagine if that was to happen today. It happened then. It must have seemed like the end of the world. It seems that some of the things that are happening today seem as though it's absolutely terminal. It could go on, but it would spoil your lunch. The point is, and I'm nearly at the end, the point is that we can read this little apocalypse of Isaiah as a foretelling of dreadful times just round the corner in our own day if we wish, but in doing so, we'll be doing exactly what others have done and have read in the centuries before us. Now, one day, we can be sure the world will end, possibly by the hand of man, but certainly, this is really gloomy, when the sun burns up, explodes, and consumes us. Don't worry, I'm told that's a billion years away, or something like that. But it could be happening sooner than that. It could be a giant meteor. There could be some other cataclysm. We just don't know. It seems permanent, but like everything else that's physical, it isn't. Now, that should really humble us and help us not to get ideas above our station in God's created order. Because ultimately, any ideas that we have that we're in charge of our lives, of our nation, of our world, any ideas that we have that we're in charge are absolutely disappearing like hot air, turn to dust. But, and in the end, God. The way to read these words, I think, is not like you'd read a science book to try and learn and understand the technical details of what may one day or what will one day happen. The way to read these words of Isaiah is to look at what they say about you, what they say to you, about you today. So whatever the future holds, we have plenty of problems of our own to deal with. But our faith provides the guide, it provides the map by which we navigate the minefield, if I'm mixing a metaphor here, we navigate the minefield we call our earth. And by earth, we might mean our land, we might mean our nation, we might mean the earth, we might mean the world, we might just mean our own space, our own little world. This passage talks to each of us. It demands a response from each of us. That's what's important in these words, much more important than whether you're inclined to see them as future prophecy or historical prediction. What is important is your response. What's important to me is my response to the challenge of Isaiah. Trust in the Lord forever. Trust in the Lord who humbles those who dwell on high and who trample on the feet, on the oppressed and on the poor. So the question, whose side? Where do you place your trust? Amen. And so we sing that song that gave the inspiration for this,